Interview with Willis Riccio, February 25th, 2009, in Boston, Massachusetts, by Kenneth Durr. Great. Well, can we start with a little bit of background?
Sure.
Did you go to Brown?
Brown University.
Undergrad, is that right?
Undergrad, right.
Okay. And how about law school?
Georgetown, JD, and LLM.
Okay. What's an LLM?
Master of Laws.
Okay. So you were in Washington, D.C. then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Did you make any connections with the SEC that way?
Well, yeah, it's sort of circuitous, if you don't mind.
Sure.
When I was at Brown, I was an English literature major. And one of the authors I ran across and liked very much was F. Scott Fitzgerald. Okay. He was the chronicler of the Roaring Twenties.
Right.
And from Fitzgerald, obviously, I got into the stock market crash of 1929. And from that, the SEC.
Huh.
When I was at Georgetown was one of the few law schools back then that taught a course in securities law. And actually, the teaching fellow, later became a judge here in Massachusetts, Fran Larkin.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, being a Brown graduate, I was quickly recruited by the Brown Club of Washington to join, and they used to hold their meetings in the National Press Building. And I went to the meetings, and one gentleman who was there, a Brown grad, was Tommy the Cork Corcoran.
Oh, okay.
And he was one of the drafters of the original Securities Act and I believe the Exchange Act.
Mm-hmm.
And he got me an interview. At the SEC. Actually, the personnel director then was Harry Pollack, Irv Pollack's brother.
Yeah.
So I went and I was still in law school and I was hired as a law clerk trainee. Don't ask me how much I made, but it was half of whatever you would get if you were a full-time lawyer.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I stayed, went two more years for my master's, and I was in the Division of Corporation Finance, which was the division everybody told me to go into.
Why?
Because a good number of the leading people in that division were with the SEC when it started.
Mm.
And they were, I must say, excellent teachers in terms of simplifying the ramifications of the securities laws.
About what time is this?
1958.
Okay.
And I think the division director was Harvey Thorson. Ralph Hocker was one of the branch chiefs. And an ex-Navy commander was there, too. And I can't recall his name, but I can see him. Tall, white hair. And I was put into one of the groups. Ted Cliston was the group chief. And the lawyers in the group were Bernard Kulick. Ed Bennett was the senior lawyer. And later on, Rodney Loeb came in. I don't know if he was part of the Loeb Rhodes family or not, but Bennett was a good teacher. And the other people that I worked under, Manny Cohen was the chief counsel for the division. Joe Romeo was one of the important people there. And Charlie Shreve was assistant director. And they would explain things in simplified fashion, which was great for me later on in my career, because I ultimately ended up being a litigator, a trial lawyer for the SEC. They did not have many. But contrary to what you may think, reading newspapers today, a lot of courts didn't have the faintest idea what the SEC was.
Mm-hmm.
In trying to get across what the laws meant, it was helpful to be able to simplify them.
Yeah. Were these things that you'd been able to study at Georgetown, and so the real practitioners were just making those concepts simpler?
Yeah, actually the course in Georgetown, as most of the courses, focused in on registration. And I teach securities law now, and actually most people who become involved with it are not going to be involved with registration. They're going to be involved on the disclosure side with the exemptions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, I learned quite a bit from these people. Manny Cohen later went on to be chairman of the commission. Jack Hennigan, who was a Brown graduate, also took over Cohen's job, and he was excellent, too, in teaching. And I had a feeling that I was connected to the past with those people, which I was.
Hmm.
And
so that fulfilled that part of you that started with the English degree, right, wanting to look at the...
And back then, each division, with the exception of, what was it called? Each division did its own enforcement. You had CorpFin, would enforce anything involving disclosure. You had trading and exchanges, T&E as they call it, would deal with broker-dealers, stock exchanges, and the young NASD back then. Then, what was it, corporate, the investment company division, they relied on CorpFin to do any enforcement, because essentially an investment company files under two statutes, the 40 Act and also the 33 Act. So the exposure I got was great. You know, I looked at registration statements and I looked at 40 Act stuff, and also got involved in litigation. And I don't mean this in a critical sense, but back then the SEC was a sloppily managed law firm. If you fouled up, the fellow who was in charge of you would just take you aside and have a beer and say, don't do this, don't do that. And, we were located back on 2nd and E Street in a temporary building. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get into some litigation aspects. Let's see, Cornucopia Gold Mines, Burt Talonfels. And there was one involving, I wish I could know, it involved Windows, as I recall. But some of the people involved were Ayn Rand, the novelist, and the football coach for Notre Dame. His name I forget too, but he was one of the great Notre Dame coaches.
These are people who had been defrauded? Or
defrauded, and also those people had. But also, I think, with respect to the Notre Dame coach, was his name that was being used to bring people. And there was no trial division or enforcement division as there is now.
Right.
There was an attempt to sort of centralize litigation, and they used people from CorpFin, an accountant, Ben Levy, and Ralph Tracy, who later became a hearing officer. But there weren't too many that litigated. Actually, the best litigator they had was a general counsel's office who worked out of Chicago, and he was an Earl Rogers type lawyer. If you ever read that
history. Tell me that.
Earl Rogers was a well dressed dandy. He'd like to have his drinky poos now.
Okay.
Jack Kinnemer was his name. And I ended up doing litigation. Now, the opening came in Boston. I'm from Rhode Island originally, and I was married in Washington. My first child was born there. So I took advantage of it to go to the Boston regional office. My wife never forgave me for leaving Washington. But, and
when was this?
This was 1960 or 61.
Okay. When you had been in CorpFin in Washington then, you know, what I've heard from other folks who started out in CorpFin is just they sit there for a year or two just looking at registration statements.
Yeah, that's a pain in the neck.
Sounds to me like you did a little more than that.
Yeah, I did, because I hope I don't get indicted for this. Enough time has passed. When I first went in, my job was to look at 10-Ks and the disclosure documents following a registration statement. And it was pretty narrow, the disclosure with respect to exemptions in item 29, and the stock was legally issued, fully paid for, and non-assessable, stuff like that. Well, back then, the files were kept in folios, yay big. And I know what they look like because I worked in the Library of Congress in the newspaper section. And they... that thick. They had all the filings, particularly U.S. Steel, American Telephone. Well, the fellow who I succeeded on the low rung of the totem pole, so to speak, didn't do much work. And I get into my office, and these things pile that high. So I started to go through them, and I said, this is crazy. I'll go nuts doing this. So late in the evening, not too late, you know, about 5:30 or so, I went out into the hallway and got one of those big gray hampers that they put garbage in. I threw them all out. And to this day, I'm sure nobody even knows it, but there is a gap in the filings of... I think the statute of limitations has passed, but destroying government property.
That's one way of taking care of a paperwork crisis.
Move that on right quickly.
All right, so you got the opportunity to go up to the Boston Regional Office. Who did you interview with up there? Is that the way it works?
They came to Washington, actually. Back then, they had what they call regional administrators conferences.
Okay.
And all the regions, as I recollect, were... The head of it was political. They were all political. In Boston, the head was a fellow named Phil Kendrick, who was the cousin of the Speaker of the House of Representatives, McCormick. So he came up. Jim Dowd came up, who was the assistant. Ed Delaney was the chief counsel. Joe Lynch, who's still around and does my taxes, he was the accountant. A number of them came up. And I talked to all of them, really, and they just had a hole in the office. I had a good academic record. I was 10th in my class when I graduated. So they accepted me, and I moved up there. And I, from there on, I became essentially a trial attorney. My title was trial attorney finance, but there weren't too many who did it. There was myself, Francis X. Pelozo out of New York. I think he's with... law firm now. I'll think of it in a moment. But I correspond with him. Jack Bookie out on the coast, who later became regional administrator. And, of course, Jack Kinnemer. Mm-hmm. And we'd go around, you know, wherever litigation showed up. And I did quite a bit in out of the Boston office. In some cases, became landmark cases. I tried a case involving Scotch whiskey receipts. It was the first time a court ruled that they were investment securities. That was in Rhode Island, and it's a reported case. Also, I did one involving...
Let's talk a little bit about that one. That was in 78, right? Yeah. Late 70s.
Yeah.
And there was something, a Rhode Island broker, and he had all kinds of things.
M.A. Lundy Associates.
Okay. How do you find out about something like this? Do you remember the specifics
on
that case?
Oh, yeah, the postal people. Post office. Yeah, they are tremendous, actually. They don't get as much credit as they deserve, the postal inspectors. But that's how we picked it up. And the issue was, do we want to try this? Well, to me, it was, you know, like waving a red flag in front of a bull, a nice theory of law and what have you. And we filed in Rhode Island. Judge Day was the trial judge in the district court.
Why was there a question about trying it?
We had to fit it into a theory, and the theory we used was the investment contract theory.
Okay. So had this trading on whiskey receipts, had that been done before?
No.
That
was the first one.
Okay.
And fortunately, the judge knew all about scotch. I learned quite a bit. And
Tell me a few of the basics.
Well...
How that scam worked, because it is kind of interesting.
The way it worked was that... Lundy, these crazy schemes oftentimes develop following periods of stock market distraint. The average guy is scared now of the stock market. They leave. So oftentimes people try to concoct ideas which don't look like ordinary investments but will attract people back in.
Okay.
So Maurice Lundy was of that ilk, and he began to look around for something to get his customers back. And he looked across the ocean, and he saw Scotch whiskey. And the reason it attracted him was, in the UK, Scotch whiskey is highly regulated. It's a major product for them. And it essentially involves two steps. Distillation of raw hooch and blending. The distillation takes place, obviously, in Scotland. And most of the distillation is done by small mom-and-pop distilleries. Under British law, the raw product has to be kept in a warehouse for 5 years before it can be blended and bottled. That forces the distiller to have to carry the inventory for that period of time, which incurs financial loss or risk. So the practice developed way before my time, whereby the distiller would sell the raw hooch in the warehouse by issuing a warehouseman's receipt, which under personal property laws is the general way you transfer merchandise in a warehouse. And the gamble was for someone who bought it that a blender down the road would want that particular distilled product. And through the years, a regular over-the-counter trading market occurred involving so-called whiskey brokers in trading this stuff back and forth. So that's what Lundy saw, and he made contact with a whiskey broker. And he had a real good sales item because, number one, scotch is viewed as the, at least back then, as the creme de la creme of booze. Everybody, you know, scotch connoted wealth. You know, you walk into a cocktail party like a scotch and soda. It's much better than, you know, give me a beer.
Yeah.
and the consumption of scotch was going up dramatically, especially following World War II. The biggest consumer of scotch prior to this point in time was the United States. Joe Kennedy made a fortune by importing a label. But that had been surpassed by West Germany. And at the time this case was brought, the biggest consumer of scotch, and I think still is, was Japan. So a lot of money moved around. You could buy a keg for $1,000. What's the other size? The big one, the reefer, was 5,000, and in between was, you know, the beer type keg, 15.5 gallons. And within a short period of time, he was hitting $1 million in terms of receipts.
So what was the problem with this?
The problem was this: you got a receipt.
Yeah.
But you didn't know whether you had Highland malt or Lowland malt. They just put anything in there. And it's where this raw hooch came from which determined its value.
Okay.
And then it got even more deleterious in the moral sense. A lot of the scotch wasn't in the warehouses.
Just,
and the final point was a lot of the warehouses never even existed.
Okay.
Now, the only way you could realize your profit by selling what you own was using Lundy and his whiskey broker. You couldn't do it yourself. And that fell into the concept of investment contract. You know, common enterprise and the efforts of others, mainly Lundy. And of course, you know, you put together a brochure, glossy, putting the figures in, consumption, and the value of various type distilled products, and the cover had a man with a bagpipe in the a lake with a goose.
Just what you'd expect.
Right.
Yeah.
And he sold quite a bit quickly. But the postal people warned us about it, that a lot of this wasn't above board. And it was a great case to try. So we tried it for 9 days. The defense counsel was Hale and Dorr, now Wilma Hale. Uh-huh. And a good friend of mine was the defense lawyer back then. Well, we became friendly afterwards. Owen Todd, who later became a judge and now is in private practice, Todd and Weld. And we do business together. So he's, but it was an interesting trial. It caught a lot of publicity, especially overseas. And Judge Day ruled that there was an investment security involved and granted the injunction and all the attributes of that.
So your job was to get this theory across and get the judge
right. Yeah. I wrote an article recently. I'll give you a copy of it if you want it.
Great, yeah.
And the investment contract approach has brought a lot of items which facially don't look like securities, investment securities products, under the ambit of the securities laws. I mean, another case I tried in Boston, SEC versus J&B Industry, nothing to do with scotch. It was a land deal in Canada where some unscrupulous promoters from Europe actually began to sell land in Varennes, Canada, along the St. Lawrence Seaway. The value obviously was access to the seaway. It was contiguous to the seaway. The problem was a lot of the land didn't exist, and a lot of it was under the St. Lawrence River. But they set up these sales outlets, and they all had initials, H&R in Rhode Island, nothing to do with the tax people, J&B in Boston, etc. And they raised $35 million in a short period of time. We worked with the Canadian authorities, and we decided to sue, basing the civil suit on the investment contract theory.
Was this after you'd done the whiskey receipts?
Oh, yeah. Okay. And it's cited as SEC versus J&B Industry. The judge was Judge Murray, federal judge. And, you know, when you go into court, you sometimes get a break. Judge Murray could have said, what's the legal basis of this suit, which says you go through the dry, well, it's section so-and-so of the 33 Act and all that. But he didn't. He asked, why do you want a receiver? Now, that gives me a chance to make an ad hominem argument. The courtroom's jammed, and I said, this is a massive securities fraud. Well, the Boston Globe next day in headlines had massive securities fraud, so what's the judge going to do? They would have convicted the Pope.
Right.
The same ruling. The efforts of others were significant and what have you, and we worked with people from the police in Montreal, and I had a nice trip there. But by the time the bond doors were closed, let me put it this way. The trigger that was interesting was that they were going to sell this land to a Liechtenstein corporation called Ferroplanachting Gesellschaft, which is AG, you know, the corporation. And they brought in, they had a show down at the Statler Hotel. It's now Boston Park Plaza. And they brought in these people who looked like real Germans, mustaches and everything else. And they were from Ferroplan, but they were all one group. And they put up $500,000 to show their good faith. And the thing was, they would sell the investor a deed at $5 a foot. And a promise to buy it back at $10 a foot. I can't remember the numbers. But right on the face of the thing, you made a profit. Right. The only thing is, you couldn't dispose of it. You had to hold it. You could borrow money on it. If somebody would give you a loan, you could take your mother-in-law up there, assassinate her, and your mother-in-law, rather, assassinate her and bury her up there. And they would do these junkets, and they'd show you the land all manicured. But that was all they had. That was the theory of the case, that you need the efforts of others to get any return. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the others were all crooks. So they just took off. They left the country, and there was nothing we could do about it beyond getting the $500,000, which never covered the losses. And the same thing turned up 3 years later in Italy. And we saw the same brochure in Italian this time.
Same people, I guess.
They were. They're very clever, too. that was a case where land, which is not normally thought of as being an investment security, was held to be an investment security.
So this is that investment contract
theory. Yeah. That is expanded. Now, the SEC used that to try and get into a lot of situations. But I remember speaking at the University of Texas, not on this, on something else. And we went out to dinner, and Alan Levinson, who used to be a director of the Division of Corporate, one of the most brilliant men I've ever met, and one of the nicest guys. Untimely death, though. And we were sitting around having dinner, and he was saying to some of my colleagues and me, you know, don't push it. The Supreme Court's going to sit on you. Well, as long as we were the plaintiff, we being the SEC, we had no problem. But then we started to get a little bit arrogant.
And pushed it.
And we pushed it into the private suits, and we started to file amicus briefs in suits that didn't really involve us. A court's very prone to listening to you when you say, I'm protecting the public. But when you're involved in a crude word, pissing match between two private parties, they're not as receptive. And we got stepped on.
When?
I can't recall the dates, but the cases, obviously, you must be aware of. United Housing Foundation versus Foreman,
okay.
And the Daniels case.
Okay.
In the Daniels case, it involved an employment contract and the Teamsters. And the Supreme Court said, no, you're not going to get it anymore. So it died. The investment company approach died for a while. Now it's come back up again. But normally it's a situation which will find itself when people are jaded about the stock market. I would say right now.
Yeah, interesting.
It's going to be maybe a problem.
Unconventional investments.
Yeah. They're not pitched as a equity type investment. You know, like people saw Scotch whiskey. They didn't realize the ramifications of it. They saw land in Canada. They saw a profit on the face of things. So the SEC is back into that business again, but not as much as they were before. But it was an interesting, interesting period.
How about mining stocks, penny stocks, things like that?
Penny stocks, that went right across the country. It started in New England. Mining, we never had anything up here. There wouldn't be anything. But I'll tell you about penny stocks. It started with what they called, we called here, the friendly hands offering. There is an exemption from registration called Regulation A under the 1933 Act. And back then it permitted you to sell $500,000 worth of securities with no registration. It was characterized as a mini registration, but that was wrong. It was an exemption. It was not a, there was no Section 11 liability. Well, there were a number of small brokers in New England, in Boston especially, that would try to underwrite various small offerings using Reg A. And under the procedures of Reg A, you had to give an investor an offering circular, which was an attenuated prospectus. However, once the offering was complete, you would file a Form 2A indicating that, and you didn't have to use the offering material. So what these people would do would be to sell all the securities to friends or people in cahoots with them, notify the SEC that they had completed the offering, and then get on the telephone and start whacking this stuff out, you know. And they could move a price from $5 a share up to $20 a share. And the case that's, I think, most poignant in the area was a case involving a Motel 128, which was out on the 128 area in Massachusetts, which is all the high-tech companies and what have you. The motel was a version of Mustang Ranch. It was rapid turnover business that catered to all the executives and the frustrated housewives in the area and what have you. They file a Reg A. And we knew all this, and that there was a tax lien involved and what have you. So I called Ruth Appleton in Washington. She's retired now. I think she lives in Florida. If she's still alive, I would hope so. And said, you know, what are we going to do with this? She said, well, have them put all these defects on the front cover of the offering circular and call it risk factors. And that was the genesis of risk factors that you see today in all the prospectuses and what have you.
Was she at CorpFin?
Yeah. Reg A was, Pat Griffin was the original assistant director in charge of small issues, and he retired and she took over.
Okay.
And she's a wonderful woman. But in any event, that's what we did. But lo and behold, they sold the issue out in one day because they didn't have to use that all those risk factors. They'd say, oh, we sold it all out,
right.
And then they get on the phone and start selling the thing. The stock went up to $27 right away. So that was an interesting period here. Now, that same sort of situation moved out into various parts of the country. It became the penny stock syndrome. Then it became the Denver hot issue market. And then it went into, what's that area in California where the high-tech stuff is?
Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it became the same type of offering. So they amended Reg A. Now you have to use the offering circular for 90 days. But it's the same thing that just went right across. In my estimation, after 27 years at the SEC, nothing changes. It just gets a different name. Now, Charlie Ponzi is back in vogue because
for sure.
of Madoff.
Right.
I'm doing an outlet. I'm going to speak on that, and I've got to do a little article on it. And maybe Ponzi schemes have been going on for years and years, and they're still going on today. It's just that the drama of Madoff has pushed it into the front lines again. Actually, you know, Ponzi is credited with developing the scheme, but that's not really true. He copied a guy named Miller, and Charles Dickens in 1844 wrote a novel called Martin Chuzzlewit, where one of the schemes involved is the pyramid scheme, which is a Ponzi scheme. But Ponzi got the glory. But he made a lot of money, $50 million, you know, and he was making $250,000 a day selling this stuff. You know, I hate to say it because I have no right to insult anybody, but a lot of these frauds succeed because of the laziness and greed of the people who are defrauded.
Right.
You know, and if you stay at the SEC long enough in this enforcement area, you can become a cynic, you know. It seems like you're swimming uphill or running uphill all the time.
You talk about the need to protect. You always had to invoke that you were going to protect the widows and orphans.
You know, the securities laws weren't designed for that. If you their disclosure, when they were first written, they were novel because they based all their virility on the concept of disclosure,
right.
Protect by giving information, at least the 33 Act. As one wag put it years ago, the act does not take away one's inalienable right to make a fool of himself. You know, it just tries to prevent others from doing it for him. In the legislative history behind the 33 Act, which was the first statute, it's designed to prevent overreaching. To my mind, that implies that you know, there is going to be some reaching. You've got to fend for yourself. Now, Joe Kennedy is oftentimes accused, he's the first chairman of the SEC.
Right.
And the joke is, well, Roosevelt wanted to put the fox in charge of the chicken coop or something like that. That's not true at all. The 33 Act was not a regulatory statute, even though we use the term regulation. The 34 Act was the first regulatory statute in the securities lexicon. Mm-hmm. Now, the powers on Wall Street really didn't care about the disclosure statute, but now they're going to be regulated.
Right.
That was a different matter.
Right.
Kennedy was very influential with Wall Street. That's why he became chairman, to calm them down so they would accept the 34 Act.
Right.
And today, of course, the 34 Act is the preeminent statute. And you can always identify a regulatory statute. It will have enabling provisions. The statute leaves it up to an expert body, and in my case, the SEC, to promulgate a rule to implement the enabling provision.
Right.
Famous example, Section 10B. Section 10B has marvelous language. You know, you can't engage in a manipulative, deceptive device or contrivance. But the last line, in contravention of such rules as the commission shall promulgate. So if there's no rule, that section is a unit. It doesn't mean anything, but they have promulgated rules.
Right.
I'm on the advisory board of BNA Securities Regulation and Law Report, and one of the members who since passed away was Milton Friedman. Uh-huh. He's the one who drafted Rule 10b-5, which began in Boston. Let's see, I was regional administrator from 78 to 85. Prior to me, it was Phil Kendrick. And I'm sorry, Jim Dowd, Phil Kendrick, and then a guy named Paul Rowan, who later became a commissioner. He called Washington and he said there's a president of a company in Boston who's going around saying his company is lousy, losing money, about to go bankrupt, and the stock is depressed. He's buying all the stock. There's nothing wrong with the company. So he's misrepresenting the status of the company and omitting to state how good the company is. What can I do? So the commission obviously said you can't use 17 because 17 only applies to offers of sales. 10B applies to purchase of sales, both sides, but there's no rule. So it fell to Milt Friedman to draft 10B-5. So what he did was simply use the predicatory language of the statute and the substantive provisions are taken from Section 17 of the 33 Act. Employ a device, scheme, or artifice to defraud, engage in a course of conduct which operates or misrepresent a material fact. That all went into 10b-5. And I used to go to meetings with him, and he said, Willis, in my wildest dreams, I never thought 10b-5 would be used for what it's being used.
Yeah.
You know, two former friends of mine at the Chicago office wrote a poem about that. And it's a whole series of paragraphs dealing with a 10b-5 violation. But the denouement is that it's really a domestic relations suit. And to show how broadly it's been used.
Yeah. Was it used against this Boston company president who was saying bad things about his own company?
Yeah.
Okay, so the idea is you find out something like this is happening, and then you go get the rule.
Well, that's one way of dealing with it. Yeah. Of course, you got to get the rule now with all the sunshine provisions and everything else. It has to be approved, and that's why the SEC got shot down several years ago when they tried to get into the hedge fund through the investment advisor. They had to publish the rule, and some fellow from Boston actually sued them, Goldstein, and prevented it. But I don't know why they're using that, because the hedge funds live because of an exemption from the 40 Act, which was designed for investment clubs. Mm-hmm. Fewer than 100 people, no public offering. It seems to me all they have to do is revoke the exemption, and they have a right to go into the investment companies to inspect them.
Interesting. Well, let's catch up a little on your career. You jumped through a number of regional administrators, people that you must have worked for.
Yeah.
And I want to get a sense of, one, what was the office like, the Boston regional office, when you came in? How many people were
18.
There? 18. All pretty much all lawyers?
No,
Did
no.
Did you have some accountants?
It was myself. The head man was not a lawyer. He was out of the industry, Phil Kendrick.
Okay.
Jim Dowd was a lawyer. Eddie Delaney was a lawyer. Myself. But when I indicated an interest in trying cases, well, they didn't object, so I got to do a lot of litigating. And I know when I left the commission, the fellow who was in charge, and I can't recall his name, of administrative proceedings, said I had argued more administrative cases than any other lawyer up to that point in time, 1985.
In the entire SEC?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can't say that I didn't try to push as much as I could.
Do you like being in a courtroom?
Yeah. And another thing that happened is, contrary to what's happening today, U.S. attorneys did not want securities cases.
Why not?
They're too difficult to get involved with. They could not always see the public benefit versus, say, drugs, narcotics, and stuff like that. With exceptions, Southern District of New York, I'm sure, Boston to a degree, but a lot of the outlying areas, Rhode Island where I live, didn't want them. But Link Alman, who was a U.S. Attorney in Rhode Island, said, if you try it, we'll take the criminal case. So, fine. I was sworn in as a special assistant U.S. attorney, and the SEC paid me, but I worked for the Department of Justice, and I got to try criminal jury cases. And that's where you see how difficult it is, because you've got to convince that jury that these esoteric concepts amount to stealing.
How do you do that?
Well, being able to simplify. I know I tried Lundy, not for Scotch whiskey. He was in another deal involving land in Florida. I opened quoting from John Donne, no man is an island. You know, you just try and get it into their heads that somebody is using a device in the form of a representation or not saying something which allows them to separate an innocent person from his or her money. And they'll buy that. But if you get up there and start saying Section 5 requires it, they don't even know what Section 5 is. And, of course, you can't tell them because that's the judge's province to instruct on the law.
So you don't get into discussions of securities laws, so to speak, or securities regulations?
You lay out that the securities laws are designed to protect the public, like you, ladies and gentlemen. Now, when you talk to the jury, you can't usurp their function, which is to find the facts. So what you do is you usurp their function by asking them questions. Hmm. I ask you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, would an ordinary person have invested in this had they known this? And then I ask you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what did the investors get in this case? And then I went over to the box of exhibits and I took each one out, dropped it on the, I made a bang, bang. This is what they got, worthless exhibits in a lawsuit. That's the way you would go at it. Hmm. But so you have to be careful not to take away their function or get into their emotions as to something. You can't do that. You can't say, wouldn't you people be upset if this happened to you? You know, you can't do that.
Did you talk to other prosecutors who did prosecute cases like
this?
Yeah. And sort of talk shop about
this? I remain friendly with a lot of them. Larry Ireson in New York. He was assisting Ike Sorkin, who's now representing Bernie Madoff.
Right.
Here in Boston, that's why I'm with this firm now, because Bill Looney, one of the partners, he was an assistant U.S. attorney, because that concept of you try it, we'll take it, that flowed over to Boston. And I would liaise with people like Bill Looney. The assistant U.S. attorneys in Boston were a good bunch. It was Davey Mazzone, who became a federal judge and passed away, Bill Looney, Steve Moulton, who died, but he was partners with Milt Friedman's daughter. And it was a good group. And I learned from them, and Paul Markham was U.S. attorney, and I had a problem once. I called him up, and I said, he was part of this group, how do I get this in evidence? He spent a half hour on the phone talking to a stupid lawyer like me, telling me how to do it. So it was a very close-knit group.
Was the SEC ever interested in maybe having this model applied elsewhere and having other people in the regions do this?
I don't know if they did. They knew what I was doing. You know, I have letters that I've got from Sparkin and Commissioner Chairman Williams, mm-hmm. especially on the criminal end. But they weren't. Now more and more are getting into it. But for the most part, the U.S. attorneys now are very interested in securities cases. As a matter of fact, they get out in front of the SEC.
Mm. Yeah, they do.
And they... will let the people they swear in work for them, but only in the sense that they do the scut work. They don't go first chair like I was doing, or even second chair. I was involved in the trial of the last investment company case that was brought criminally here in Boston before Judge Skinner. And my co-counsel was Dick, what's his name? He defended Admiral Poindexter later on. Think of it. He went with Fulbright and Jaworski when he left the government. Mm. We did stay together a lot. Francis Peloso, he's with Morgan Lewis and Brockius. That's the name of the firm. You know, he drops a line because when I got out in the private practice, one of my areas of concern was that the SEC had become, the NASD had become a government actor. We had similar feelings. He wrote an article. I wrote an article. It was published on now FINRA being a government actor. Mm-hmm. The ramifications, well, if they're not deemed government actors, you have no constitutional rights. And they maintain they're not a government agency unless you sue them. Then they say we are a government agency. But they're organized just like the SEC. They do the same thing the SEC does. So I think the time has come either to abolish FINRA or folded into the SEC.
You talked about Stanley Sporkin and Harold Williams and all that, and I'm wondering how much you consulted with folks in D.C., particularly, of course, the 80s. Early 80s, you're in up here, mm-hmm. and you're doing some pretty vigorous enforcement, and that's the time period when the SEC's enforcement was pretty strong as well.
That's right. It was a friendly atmosphere. Number one, when I was regional administrator, I reported to the chairman. I didn't report to a division director.
Okay.
I never disagreed with Stanley. But if I did, I could go directly to the commission. And they were all like that because Malin Frankhauser, who's now with Kirkpatrick and Lockhart, he was the first administrator that came from the staff. He got the New York office. And I think I was only the second or third that came from the staff. Now,
okay.
They're virtually all from the staff. with the exception, I think, of New York. New York is still so big an operation that there's a political attractiveness. And normally it's the associate directors that really run it. But we were a friendly group.
I'm wondering about maybe coordinating. There's the for example, in the 80s, there's that shift to insider trading.
Yeah.
Was that the kind of thing that you would say, okay, well, let's try to work on this front for a while?
It was. And we did one of the good cases, SEC versus McDonald, which went up twice to the First Circuit, the second time en banc. On the issue of when notice is actually received. I recall making the final argument in the case before Judge Boyle, and he looked down at me, and he had sort of a sarcastic sense of humor. He said, "Counselor, what's wrong with this? Doesn't everybody do it?" And that's a legitimate question, because a lot of people, it's a victimless crime. The way we'd argue it was, well, I'm here to protect the integrity of the marketplace. Well, as you know from what's happening today, there's no integrity in the marketplace at all. And I think the SEC should confine itself to situations where there's an attempt to corrupt the system, like Milken, Boesky. They did, apart from the insider trading, they did devious things to get the information. But if somebody has a Thanksgiving dinner and his son brings a college friend along and somebody happens to be a president of a company and blurts something out and the friend trades on it, you shouldn't be suing this guy for breaching a fiduciary duty.
Yeah. Did you have some other cases that popped up that I wanted to touch on? Stock value manipulation case involving Gilman Services. That was also in the 80s, 83. And something called Computer Store, and again, this, manipulating the value of the stocks.
And there's Whiteboard, which was another one. Then the investment contract thing started to come back again. One case involved a woman called Elizabeth Gann, G-A-N-N, and she ran a commodities pool, so to speak, and the money, where did it go? Went to one of her associates in New York called John. Nobody ever found John. So we used to refer to the case as the missing John. Case of the missing John. Manipulation is really a disclosure violation. Failure to tell you that the stock is not being freely traded, it's being manipulated. Actually, those friendly hand cases were a form of manipulation. And I can't recall the names of all the cases in the 80s. White, A.J. White, that made new law. It went up to the Supreme Court. Certiorari was denied. Then, of course, Stanley left and Fedders came in.
Right.
It's pro and con as to, how effective he was or what have you. I know he was, if I can go back a bit.
Go back.
All right. I said at the outset we were a sloppily managed law firm, but friendly. Jimmy Carter, the president, wanted to remedy the fact that government employees were not making a lot of money. As a matter of fact, I was looking at a letter when I transferred to Boston. My salary was $4,998. Well, that's dollars back then, but still it was not big.
Yeah.
And he passed the Senior Executive Service Statute, which did several things. Number one, it allowed executives, which a regional administrator would be, to accumulate their annual leave. You didn't have to use it. Up until that point, you had to use it. You could save 30 days, but I ended, when I left the SEC to go to the NASD, I had a year's salary. That was one good thing. Then you were supposed to get bonuses. Well, the biggest bonus I ever got was $300. And finally, the salary levels, the GS levels, which you would work under, were raised. Technically, I should have made as regional administrator $112,000. I never got over $68,000. Congress kept capping pay scales. That's why I left, but that's getting ahead of myself. When they went into this method of compensating executives. Now they are faced with, how do we measure performance? Well, that brought the management types into the game, and the SEC changed from that point on. It became a numbers game. It's easy to say, how many enforcement cases did you bring? Well, actually, if the agency's functioning well, then they shouldn't be bringing enforcement cases in the regulated area anyway, because that's what regulation is all about, prophylactic. Enforcement is reactive. And that's the problem they face today, and the embarrassment they face when Congress was just as responsible for what happened with Madoff as anybody else, is that they let the regulation side atrophy. And they, they went enforcement. But that's because the management types needed something to count. And it's easy to count the number of cases. And when Fettes came in, he made the faux pas of calling me up and saying, your quota for the year is 25 cases. Hmm. Well, if that ever got out in the street, you wouldn't win any cases, because the first thing defense lawyer is going to say is, hey, he's got a quota, he's got to write traffic tickets. Right. So any close case, you were in a hole. So,
this was John Chad's thing, where he was going to come down with hobnail boots and all.
Yeah, well, that's because he got enthused about the insider trading publicity. Up until that time, he was not a big fan of enforcement. As a matter of fact, his big joke, which was quoted, was, what is a tragedy? A tragedy is a bus full of government employees going over a cliff with one empty seat.
Right.
But when he saw all the publicity that was being generated, well, it made him feel good.
Okay.
But even under Shad, I reported to him. I never reported to a director. And I'll tell you, I don't know if this can be quoted, but I was always close with the press. I wanted to be a reporter when I was a kid, but my guidance counselor in high school, junior high school, discouraged me. But I used to play big story reporter, get my father's hat and put the sign press.
Yeah.
And when I came to Boston with the SEC, I was very good. And I used to leak things, not in a bad way, but reporters would want to know, not when the press release comes out, but before, are you going to bring an action? And explain things to them. So I ended up being able to get into the Boston Press Club as the only non-member of the working press. But that's because I would help them. Well, the reporters, some of them were friendly. Some of them, you're going to watch them. Some of them would be, just like, what's his face in Washington, who's now ill, I guess. I just read his book. I can't think of his name again. Mental Block.
Novak.
Novak. Mm-hmm. Some of them will use you, but that's the risk you take.
Right.
In any event, one of the young reporters for the Boston Globe, we were chatting, and she said, there's a big, at the time, there was a proxy fight going on between the owners of the stadium, which was then called the Schaefer Stadium, and the Boston Patriots, which are now the New England Patriots.
Right.
The stadium was publicly held because the initial financing went through the SEC. And they built it on a shoestring. If you ever went there, you'd see what I mean. They had one restroom for 40,000 people. It was disgusting.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
Yeah. But in any event, it was a proxy fight. And even Nicholas Scalabrine, who was the owner of the Montreal Alouettes, became involved. She told me, she said, some of the sports writers who have columns, etc., are being importuned financially or otherwise to slant their columns in a certain direction to get the people to change their proxies, because you can revoke a proxy until it's voted. And that may have been going on both sides, so I'm not going to single out one or the other. But we had that information. We did a little investigation. So we decided to sue. Now, I went before the commission, and it was almost midnight, presenting the case. The chairman was John Shad. A new fellow from Texas was on. The female commissioner was Barbara Thomas, who liked me, but she was out. She wasn't there. The other two commissioners were Phil Loomis, formerly general counsel, and Irv Pollack. Shad did not want to bring the case. He was afraid of the First Amendment. And we felt we could overcome it because the First Amendment does not shield fraud. it finally came to a vote. Shad and the new fellow voted against it. The two staff, former staff members, Pollock and Loomis, voted to bring it. The fifth member of the commission wasn't there, so a tie vote killed it. But that would have been a fantastic case to bring.
Yeah, it would have been pretty noteworthy,
too. Oh, absolutely. No question about it.
Huh. So did you have to go before the commission every time you wanted to bring a
significant case? No. Generally, somebody down there would do it for you.
Okay.
Stanley Wood or one of his assistants. They were all pretty. Wally Timoney and those. Actually, that division changed when Stanley left. I mean, he was not a hot ass at all. He was, you know, just one of the guys. Mm. And he appreciated what you would do. And, I never had any procedural problems with him.
Any other notable cases from your time that we haven't talked about?
Oh, God, I have to think a little bit. It was, A.J. White.
Yeah, let's go into that a little bit.
White was a small brokerage firm in Rhode Island. And they did underwritings. There was a company in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, called Develco, Inc., and there, what they did was to rehabilitate old buildings. And their biggest achievement was the rehabilitation of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad Station up in Woonsocket. They turned it into a boutique, stores, and shops. And, I'm something of a railroad buff because I commute. But the New Haven Railroad Stations were all artistic masterpieces. If you see them and you visit them, and some of them have turned up this way. So they felt they wanted to get more money, and they should go public. So they got a good lawyer from New York. He was a former commissioner. And they decided to file a registration statement to raise money in a public offering. Since they were a speculative company, obviously, they couldn't attract the big underwriting firm. So they went to A.J. White and what he underwrited. Well, there are two basic types of underwritings, firm commitment or best efforts. Now, firm commitments generally relate only to high-quality companies because in a firm commitment underwriting, the underwriter is at risk up front. He actually buys the stock and then resells it at a markup. Mm-hmm. In a best efforts underwriting, the underwriter is only an agent, not a principal. And he agrees to use his or her best efforts to sell as much stock as they can. And for that, they get a commission. The problem with the best efforts was the underwriters would sell maybe $200,000 worth of stock and couldn't sell anymore. They said, the hell with it, we're out of it. That left all the people who bought high and dry. So they came up with a variation of the best efforts. Best efforts with a minimum, which meant that if they did not raise a minimum amount of money by a certain time, they'd have bought the whole thing and give all the money back. And the amount of money was negotiated. What was the minimum amount that the issuer needed in order to remain viable? And that would be the minimum. They had to raise it within 30 days, and with permission of both parties, they could extend it to 60 days.
Now, these are SEC rules we're talking about here?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's the type of contract they entered into with Develco. And they began to use their best efforts to sell stock. Now, under the SEC rules, the money raised prior to the minimum has to be put in escrow with an independent escrow agent. Generally, it should be a bank. And that's where this thing becomes more interesting. Okay. The bank chosen was the Industrial National Bank of Rhode Island, which later became Fleet National Bank, which later became Bank of America. There was a loan officer at that bank who was corrupt. In other words, he would make loans that were unauthorized if he got a kickback. Okay. The offering commences, and it becomes sticky wicket. They sold a lot of stock. They're near the closing point, but they can't break escrow because they haven't sold enough. So they get an extension for another 30 days. Again, they can't meet it. So the underwriters come up with a device. One guy says, look, I have friends who will take out loans. And I know we can get them to take out as much money as is necessary to make the minimum. Well, he was related to this corrupt loan officer. So he goes there, and the loan officer for Greece agrees to make non-designated loans. You know, I think it's against the law to make a loan to purchase securities. These were, you know, open-ended loans. Mm-hmm. And the people who were inveigled into borrowing were all members of a club called the Warwick JCs. I guess this type of club is all over the place. You know, you shoot pool, you get a cheap beer, watch game, the football games on Monday night or what have you. Mm-hmm. So none of these people had the wherewithal. Most of them were unemployed to take out loans. And they said, don't worry, just go in and take out a loan. So they all trooped in, and they all got $25, $30 to take out these loans. And the loan officer would give them the loans, but they never got the money. The money from the loans was deposited in the escrow account. Now, oddly enough, the amount of money deposited was the amount the offering was short. But that's only one side of the coin. We'd pick that up. The SEC would pick that right up. To cover it, the other partner said, I have a lot of customers who didn't want to buy the first time around, but now I'll ask them if I can use their accounts to put stock in it. It won't cost them anything. Well, the customer said, oh, that's fine. Yeah, you can do that. This procedure is called establishing a wooden account. And he put stock in all these accounts. They didn't pay for anything. The amount of stock put into the wooden accounts equaled the amount of stock that would be purchased if the loan money was used to purchase stock. So now they put it together, and they notify the issuer, we've made the minimum, we're out. Now, the reason they want to get out is they can make a market in the stock. Now, under the SEC rules, Rule 10b something, you can't make a market in a security as long as you're underwriting it. Obviously, you could manipulate the price. But the real money is making the market. So they began to make a market, and they moved the price of the stock right up. Then they sold it out, and with the money they paid off the people who had their accounts used, they paid off the loan officer, and they split whatever else they had.
Wow.
So how did we pick it up? It's luck. A lot of these things are just luck.
Yeah.
You know, Congress was very unfair saying that the SEC missed something. A lot of it is luck. The FBI was investigating the loan officer because it's a national bank. They picked up the deposits of the money from these spurious loans. And the loan officer, in order to keep things straight in his own mind, would write on the bottom of the check, or whatever they used to deposit in the account, Develco Inc. The FBI agent focused on the words or the abbreviation Inc. In his mind, he said, Inc. obviously means incorporation. What government agency can I talk to that deals with corporations? Well, that's the SEC. So he came over and talked to us. And I said, well, pull what we have on Develco Inc. Well, we did pull it, and it showed that they had a public offering and what have you. But I sent one of the investigators down to the brokerage firm and take a look at it. Because we had suspicions of these canned offerings. There was another one, Viking Airways, which you can't prove it. You've got to have a break. So he goes down. Now, you have to keep a ledger in connection with a new issue that you're underwriting, indicating who's buying and selling it. Well, for a period of time, the sales were legitimate, but they weren't enough. All those names were dutifully entered into the ledger. When the sales became false, they still had to account for the wooden accounts. So those names were put in the ledger. But whoever was keeping the books, for whatever reason, drew a line across the page separating the good purchases from the bad purchases. Now the investigator said, well, what's up is good, what's bad, down is in hell is bad, so we subpoenaed all the ones below the line. Of course, wow. These people said, oh, yeah. They didn't want any part of it, and that's how we got it. It was appealed, To the Circuit Court of Appeals, and Judge Bailey Aldridge said, you know, it's implicitly a part of the law that when you have a public offering, you are going to have a bona fide public offering. And the reason for that is so that investors have a right to rely on the fact that this is not rigged. There is a demand for this stock. And he said, in this situation, it was rigged. And also he said there was a failure to disclose, which violates 17 and 10B. What did they fail to disclose? So we're going to fudge the offering. And he said there's an implied misrepresentation. What's the misrepresentation? That we're going to raise this money in a bona fide public offering. So that became false. He said put them all together, it constitutes a course of conduct, etc.
Okay.
And from the circuit court, they appealed to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court denied certiorari. So it was a good law case. A couple of other regions, Denver in particular, I remember, followed that case.
One of the it looked like a big case, or at least it got some headlines toward the end of your time with the SEC, was involved the Bank of Boston and international transactions.
It was a bank of, or Bank of New England?
Might have been Bank of New England.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
There was the issue of international transactions not being properly reported or something like that?
It could be. That would be under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Yeah.
Okay. Who were some of the folks that you relied on when you were director of the regional office?
Well, my other colleague administrators, we would call constantly.
Okay.
Bob Davenport, Mike Walensky, Mike Stewart. He was in Texas, then he went to Los Angeles. Walensky left the commission, went to, he left Washington and went to Atlanta. And New York was, they had Ike Sorkin, Larry Ellison, Eddie Nordlinger. We still correspond, and I was with them all 2 weeks ago at the SEC alumni dinner.
Okay.
I saw, what's her name, Carla, is it?
Carla Rosati, yeah.
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 Rosati.
Right. Okay. Did you find that the issues that you dealt with and your problems were pretty much the same regardless of where you were?
Yeah, there would be exceptions. For instance, there's no way Boston was going to have any mining problems or geology problems.
Right.
Denver generally had all that. And they had a special person dealing with that who worked there. You know, he was a geologist.
Mm-hmm.
So those things were exceptions. But as far as stock manipulation, sale of unregistered securities, investment contract, broker-dealer problems, they were pretty much the same nationwide.
Okay. Did you, you came into the regional office from the Washington office.
Yeah.
Did you have folks who were doing that when you were in charge?
Coming in from Washington?
Yeah.
I think I was the first. I think the second, because Malin Frankhauser went to New York. But then they all seemed to. They liked the regional climate, and I must say that Washington was bureaucratic,
mm-hmm.
and you had a chance to do your own thing if you went to a regional office, either as an assistant or as the head. And the regions themselves, I think, were happy with that, because prior to that time, as I said, most of them were politically led, but they were small. You know, when I started with the SEC, there were only 1,800 people nationwide. Boston had 18. Now they get over 100. And that's why I get upset again when I watch those hearings with Congress. I mean, for years you've underfunded us,
yeah.
And now you're saying we can't do the job.
Right.
Well,
you started with 18. How many people were in the office when you left? In 85? Right?
46.
46, okay. So that's...
That was a crowning achievement of my career.
That's a very large increase.
It is.
You were, at that point, you had, what, Boston, Providence...
You know, jurisdiction?
Yeah.
We had all of New England.
All of New England.
Or wherever else they needed help. But that was true of all the regions. If,
right.
You know, if you needed help, that's how I got to litigate in other districts.
Okay. Was 46 people sufficient to do that job?
No. No. One of the areas we were very weak in, and still are, I keep talking we, once you work for the company, you always work for the company, like the CIA,
mm-hmm.
but is investment advisor. When I was there, I had two people doing it, in I don't know how many hundreds of advisors you have in New England. It became a problem to the point where Massachusetts proposed an investment advisory statute. And I was permitted by the powers that be in Washington to testify before the Massachusetts General Court, as it were, or a subcommittee, in favor of the bill. And the reason I was doing it was we felt that would take pressure off us. But the night before, and I was the first SEC person to be able to do that, testify in a political setting of a state. Mike Unger was the head of securities, a good friend of mine, and he was supportive. But the industry here wanted no part of it. But in any event, before I testified, the night before, John Shad called me at home. And he said, Willis, whatever you do, don't say the SEC can't do the job. He said, say that we're in favor of the bill because we think that will enhance our ability to police investment advisors. That's what I said. And the bill didn't pass.
The word enhance wasn't enough.
No. Okay. Well, there was a lot of political pressure not to do that because, you know, as you can suspect, Boston is a hotbed for investment advisors. It all started here. And I did quite a bit of work with the Advisors Act. I did the first case involving the advertising rules, SEC versus Spear and Staff. There's another case where the SEC didn't want to go to court. They said, let's try it in our own forum because we may get shot down in court. There was a constitutional question, which later came to fruition in the Howey case. The Lowy case, L-O-W-E, before the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court said a letter, a publisher of a bona fide newspaper is exempt under the First Amendment. This wasn't quite the First Amendment, but it had overtones. If you read the advertising rules, the last thing is sort of a catch-all, otherwise materially false or misleading. Well, Spear and Staff were letter writers, and there were a lot in those days. And they would entice subscriptions and give you advice by mail. You know, you get a letter. But their advertising, you know, had flags and everything else on it, and the fine print said, you know, we can't guarantee anything, but you have to look at it like
right.
that. So we used that as a fulcrum to bring a case saying that this was misleading because it clouded the minds of a prospective subscriber as to what was really involved. You know, they had dollar signs and big capitals and we got a good opinion in the matter of Spear and Staff, but it was a commission opinion. It never did go to court. But you might say it's the law today.
Okay.
And we had several cases involving investment advisors in this region. And again, because the place is loaded with investment advisors. The hard fact is the Investment Advisors Act is not suitable to the community it's now responsible for. When it was originally passed, it was an afterthought, hitched on to the Investment Company Act. And it was designed to interdict tipsters and stock manipulators. But it can't do it. Nobody anticipated back then the number of people that would need help the way. I mean, nobody figured everybody in the world is going to invest.
Right.
They haven't got time to do it, so they have to hire these people. And the act is just a eunuch. It can't service the community it was designed to the ordinary investor. It just can't. And it should be rewritten, frankly.
Yeah, and a lot of states are involved in
it. It's just not sufficient. And, you know, talk about enabling provisions. The act is, the SEC has attached rules to provisions which have nothing to do with fraud, you know, just so they could get it in. They lost the Goldstein case, and I was on a committee of regional administrators to look at the act and suggest changes. And what we came up with that worked was the brochure rule.
Hmm.
You know that. But one area we focused on and we could not resolve was qualifications to become an advisor, because the hard fact of life was a guy with 5 degrees from Harvard was a lousy advisor, and some guy who hung around a pool parlor was very good.
Yeah.
So the compromise was you have to put your educational background for 10 years, and then let the customer decide.
Okay. disclosure, so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, you talked a little bit about your decision to leave the SEC. And I'm wondering what got you to
why I did it?
Yeah, and what got you to NASDAQ?
Principally money. I would have stayed for the SEC. Yeah. I love the agency, yeah. And my colleagues did. And they all left for the same reason, money. But the I do a lot of speaking. You know, I speak all over the country and on securities law. And to this day, the SEC brings me in once every year or so to lecture to their new employees on the 33 and 34 Act, which I'm delighted to do, but I get a big kick out of. These are their basic statutes.
Yeah. And they're bringing you in to lecture on them.
And I did the same for the NASD for years. Okay. And the NASD had a great general counsel, Frank Wilson. He was a former AUSA, and I think he was a pilot during World War II, or at least he flew. And he appreciated the aspects that I presented in terms of my enforcement background, my litigation background, my speaking background. And at that time, Gordon Macklin was the head of NASD. He was a Brown grad. So they pitched me after the Scotch whiskey case to come with them in Washington. That I didn't want. And I think they viewed me, right or wrong, as a way of upgrading their image beyond being a union for broker-dealers, which many people, and that, for the NASD, that was my biggest achievement, getting the papers to say we weren't. And in 1984, they came to me in Boston, and they said, how much money do you want? And I said, well, I don't want to go to Washington again. My wife would have said yes, but they said, well, Bill Clendenin, who's the head now, will agree to go to New York and open up Boston. And you become a vice president. There's been no offices in the districts. So I thought about it, and I said, all right, because I had a family, and they paid me a lot of money.
Were you going to look at enforcement in particular?
That's ultimately why I left the NASD, is because I was pretty much an executive and not a lawyer anymore. I still continue to write. I still continue to lecture. I even was invited to speak in Poland to their new stock market. Mm-hmm. But the enforcement aspect was de minimis. And, I think all the years I was there, we had about three cases that we'd call adversary in nature, nothing in court. That was all handled by the general counsel's office, and they in turn farmed that out. Now, when I went into private practice, they hired me, the NASD, to handle their outside litigation. So, I mean, they were a great place to work. And financially, they were magnificent.
When did you leave NASD?
1999, December
31. Okay. Any highlights from those years that we should talk about?
With the NASD?
Yeah.
Well, speaking in Poland was one. I still lecture to the SEC and the NASD both. The development of the NASDAQ stock market. That's one of the jobs the executives had, was to pitch the NASDAQ market to the states. And I had no problem doing that because when I was with the SEC, I worked closely with them. As a matter of fact, NASA got its big boost, not from me, but from the securities director in Massachusetts, Ray Cochi, who was out of the industry, and he boomed it. But he would use me. When they brought a case, I'd do the case for him. Hmm. And then I wouldn't go up front, but put it together. And Irv Pollack was in cahoots with that. He was a big mover for the states. And that's how NASA... I still go to NASA every year, and I lecture to them in Florida, there was a lot of intercourse between the various. Now the SEC is becoming a little bit standoffish. They have too many people who really don't, look at the agency as a fraternity. They used the word collegiality, but collegiality ended when Sparkin left and Fettes came in and Shad came in.
Yeah.
For a while it came back when Harvey Pitt came on, but he got crucified for nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cox is a nice man, but I don't, they need more staff people. Now they've got two, Elise Walter, Mary Shapiro. You know, Mary did, she was actually chairman when I guess Donaldson, she was interim chairman, I know, because everybody had left.
Right, early on.
Yeah, and Elise Walter used to be with the commission. I worked with her for years.
Right.
And so maybe they'll get that esprit de corps back, which they have lost. It's still the best agency in the government. And they say, well, people only come there to get experience. Well, why not?
Right.
That was true when I was there.
Well, if, like you say, once in the company, always in the company,
right.
It's only going to help to have all these people in the company out there in the rest of the country.
That's the way I look at it.